Today, continue my conversation with Daniel Gordis, the author and academic, about former Israeli Prime Minister Menachem Begin, the subject of Gordis' new book. It's called Menachem Begin, The Battle for Israel's Soul. You had some sort of wonderful details in the book. One of my favorites was his oldest son, Benny, describing at the age of 10, realizing that his father, who'd been hiding in and posing as a rabbi, was in fact Menachem Begin, that his own son didn't know this, and every day on the radio he was hearing about how they were searching for this evil fellow, Menachem Begin, and discovered that in fact that was dad. Loved that detail.
Yeah, there's a lot of kind of very poignant elements in Begin's life. There's that element of Benny kind of coming to terms with the fact, as you so well put it so well, that this horrible person about whom he'd been hearing was actually his own father. There are very poignant moments. He's in Soviet prison. You know, we take it for granted, of course, that he got out of Soviet prison because we know that there was a story that followed it. But obviously, most people who were arrested by the Soviets at that period were never heard from again. And he's languishing in Soviet prison, and his wife smuggles into him a handkerchief that has three letters on it, O-L-A. And for the life of him, he couldn't figure out whose initials those were and what she was trying to tell him. And one of his co-prisoners actually said to him, no, it's not initials, it's actually a Hebrew word, Ola, which means I'm moving to Israel, which was her way of telling him, if you ever do get out, don't look for me here in Russia and don't go back to Poland. I'm going to be in Palestine. And there's a way in which that story is very similar to the Sharansky story, in which Nathan Sharansky, Natan Sharansky, Anatoly Sharansky, as he's called back then in Soviet Russia, is arrested, and Avital, his wife, makes her way to Israel and waits for him many years later. He comes out of prison also. So there are, as you say, there are very, very moving moments. There's the moving moment when he is in Los Angeles. His wife is in the hospital in Jerusalem. She'd had asthma, very bad respiratory problems her whole life. And he was prime minister when he was supposed to go to L.A., and he said to her, I'm not going to leave you, and she was intubated, but she was not dying, or nobody thought she was, at least. And she wrote him a note, you must go to L.A., it's very important, I'll be here, wait, you know, just go ahead and go and come back. And, of course, as people who read the book will find out, she died while he was in Los Angeles, and he moaned on the plane the entire time back, Lama Azavti Ota, Lama Azavti Ota, why did I leave her, why did I leave her? And this was a kind of an echoing of his having fled Poland for Russia, leaving his family behind as the Nazis were making their way into Poland. And he was always pursued in his lifetime by a sense of, why did I leave my family? Why did I leave my family?
Yeah, family, parents, and brother who died in the Holocaust.
Correct. The Nazis killed his father, his mother, and his brother.
Yeah. What was, for you, the biggest surprise in researching the book?
The biggest surprise for me was discovering that he was both Israel's most Jewish prime minister and, at the same time, Israel's most liberal prime minister. And when I say liberal, I don't mean liberal in terms of left-wing or right-wing, Democratic Party versus Republican Party. I mean liberal in the sense of committed to the basic civil liberties that ought to be at the heart of any democracy. It was Menachem Begin who was instrumental in ending the military rule over Israel's Arab citizens, which most people don't even remember anymore. Most people listening to your program probably have no idea that in the early days of the state, Israeli Jews were under civil judicial authority and Israeli Arabs were under military authority. And at a certain point, Begin said, this is not okay. These people are citizens of a democratic country. They have to be under the same civil authority as anyone else. Very few people would have imagined that it would be Begin, of all people, who would be so instrumental in removing that military rule. Begin was a major proponent of the settlement movement, by the way, as was the left-wing Labor Party. People nowadays think of the settlement as a left versus right issue, but back in the early days, post-67, it was both major parties who were in favor of building, and he was instrumental in getting a settlement built in a place called Elon Moreh, and the Israeli Supreme Court ruled one day that the land on which that settlement had been built had been inappropriately expropriated, and it could not stay there. And somebody expected Begin to kind of fight back and say, I'm not going to listen to the court. And he said a very famous line, Yesh Shoftim Birushalayim. There are judges in Jerusalem, meaning the Supreme Court reigns supreme. If the Supreme Court rules, I, as the Prime Minister, will obey everything that it said. When he was ailing and there were protesters outside his apartment holding up gigantic numbers indicating the numbers of casualty in the Lebanon war, he was literally, his heart was breaking from this. And his advisor said, you know, we can just move them down the block. You don't have to wake up every morning, look out the window, and see the newest numbers. And he said, no, this is democracy. These people have every right to stand wherever they want to. And if they're here to bother me, then I'm going to be bothered, because that's what a democracy is. So I think for me the most surprising thing was to learn that this man who was so reviled by Hannah Arendt and so hated by Albert Einstein, and your own father didn't like him very much apparently, was actually a great liberal in the best sense of the word. Civil rights, civic rights, the rule of law, the authority of courts and so forth. I wasn't fully aware of that when I embarked on the book, and I found him an extraordinarily interesting person because of that.
Well, you know, on the rule of law issues, you know, my father might have a begrudging respect on that level. But looking at Lebanon, one of his great failures at the end of his sort of political life, one of the ironies of that war is that it in many ways destroyed forever the sort of moral high ground that Israel was able to take. Is that why he went into hiding? I mean, what, you know, was it the death of his wife? I mean, what was it that really drove him into the shadows?
It's a good question, and I don't think anybody really knows. I argue in the book that there were a combination of three major factors that drove him out of office and into hiding as a really very much of a broken human being. One was the death of his wife. This was one of those old-fashioned love stories. He met her early on in his life. He, a few days or a few weeks later, wrote her a letter that said, "My lady, I only met you a short while ago, but I feel as if I've known you my whole life." They were married shortly thereafter. He loved her till the end of her days, and, you know, we don't think of those kinds of stories as being possible anymore, but they really are. And when she died, a huge part of his heart died with her. That was the first thing. The second thing is that he was really failing physically. He had heart problems. He had blood pressure problems. He eventually had prostate problems. He had a whole array of issues that were going wrong, and that made it much more hard for him to govern. And then the Lebanon War. I don't know that he would have known in the early 1980s that Israel had lost the moral high ground and would lose it for a very long time. But what he did know was that, first of all, Sharon had lied to him. And he had a kind of an intrinsic trust of Israeli generals because they seemed to him to be kind of biblical figures. These were the guys who were the modern incarnation of what you saw in the biblical book of Joshua and the biblical book of Judges. And to have had someone who he trusted so much and really revered, like Ari Sharon, lie to him, I think, broke him. And then, of course, there were the hundreds of Israeli casualties, and I don't mean wounded, but killed, who broke his heart. And there was, of course, no real military accomplishment. So the combination of Eliza's death, his own failing physical health, and the recognition that he had won the Nobel Peace Prize, but had now gotten Israel mired in a war from which it was really not clear how anybody was going to get Israel out, I think just was not the way that he wanted to end his life, and he died very much a broken person.
My guest is the Senior Vice President of Shalem College in Jerusalem and author of many books, Daniel Gordis. We're discussing his new book, Menachem Begin, The Battle for Israel's Soul. You know, now we're sort of at the end of this interview. I do want to go back to the beginning and his relationship with Jabotinsky. Describe his sort of his birth in that part of Jewish history.
Well, Jabotinsky, as you know, was the architect of what's called revisionist Zionism. What was revisionist about it was he was revising the way in which Zionists thought about what it was going to take to build a Jewish state. Jabotinsky believed that the Zionists were being far too accommodating, first of the Turks and then of the British, and that if they wanted to make a Jewish state, they were going to have to push and push hard. Eventually, actually, Jabotinsky and Begin broke over how much force to use. Begin wanted to use even more force to dislodge the British than Jabotinsky did. Jabotinsky dies in 1940. So it's clear that Europe is getting darker, but it's before the massive assault on Polish Jewry and the eradication of 90% of Poland's 4 million Jews. So Jabotinsky never lived to see that, though Begin, of course, did. But Begin comes under the sway of an extraordinarily powerful figure, a great orator, although Begin would probably supersede him even in his oratorical skills. Begin had started out in the Shomer HaTzair, a much more liberal youth group that his father had put his kids in, and then his father decided that the Shomer HaTzair cared more about socialists all over the world than it did Jews anywhere, and he pulled them out and put them in Beitar. Begin eventually takes over Beitar in Poland and is really the heir of Jabotinsky. If you want to look a little bit at the ideological chain, it's Jabotinsky, Begin, perhaps, I guess, Netanyahu, although Netanyahu was a different kind of a bird altogether. But there is the Likud party is really Begin's creation, and Begin's creation of Likud is in many respects the embodiment of Jabotinsky's worldview.
And finally, one of the greatest shocks of his life was when he was actually elected prime minister in 1977. Tell me about that.
Well, he had lost countless elections. He had lost, I believe, 8 elections at that point. And in 1977, he was really getting ready to give up the ghost. And there were a lot of supporters of his who were saying, basically, he was dragging down the Likud party. And as long as Begin was at the helm, he was never going to win. And they were going to give him one last chance, and then he was going to be forced out. He was elected in 1977 for a variety of reasons. Number one, the country was getting really sick and tired of the Labor Party. It was Golda Meir at the helm of the Labor Party who would let Israel get dragged into completely unprepared and caught off guard in the Yom Kippur War, in which 3,000 Israeli soldiers died. Then Yitzhak Rabin's wife was found to have a foreign bank account, a relatively small amount of money, but back then an unthinkable transgression for Israelis. And when basically the combination of Golda Meir and then Yitzhak Rabin and Leah Rabin having this account, many, many Israelis, even those who had been traditional supporters of the Labor Party, had really had enough. And all of a sudden, Begin, who was known to be completely a straight shooter, had no personal property to speak of whatsoever, owned one suit, never owned an apartment at that point, was always renting. He raised his 3 teenage children in a one-bedroom apartment, and he and his wife pushed the 2 sofas together at night to make a little bed for themselves. He lived in the most humble of ways. He was kind of a breath of fresh air to Israelis. But here, I think, is the really great story about Begin. He was elected at the end of the day on the strength of the North African Jews, the Sephardim, who had never really been given their due by the Israeli white elite Ashkenazi Labor Party. And they saw, ironically, in this Polish gentleman who always wore a tie, a man who actually took them seriously and revered them. They never felt the condescension from Begin that they felt from Ben-Gurion and his cronies. And that was really what I found so unbelievably appealing about Begin. He may have been a European gentleman. He may have been an attorney. He may have been very highly educated. But he actually loved Jews, whoever they were. White, black, rich, poor, educated, uneducated. That was the soul, the Jewish soul that he brought to the Jewish state. It was standing for that Jewish soul for 29 years in the opposition that ultimately got him elected in 1977, much to his own surprise, as you so correctly point out. And I think that as we reevaluate his legacy and think once again what it is that he has bequeathed to Israelis and non-Israelis, to Jews and to Gentiles, people all across the world, it is a reminder that Israel at its greatest moments is about a kind of an absolute commitment to the rule of law, an embrace of Jews, black and white and dark-skinned and light-skinned and educated and uneducated and rich and poor. Begin, the Polish gentleman, was actually much more of a pluralist than anybody gives him credit for. And if this book, in some respect, gives people a chance to rethink what he stood for and to rethink what it is that he bequeathed to us, I'll be very gratified.
The book is Menachem Begin, The Battle for Israel's Soul, written by my guest, Daniel Gordis. Thank you, sir.
Thanks so much for having me.